please stand or take whichever posture works best for you for the reading of the gospel. I guess you understand. Luke 21:5-19. Some of his followers began to point out to him the beauty of the great lodge with its handsomely carved logs and its large stones and ceremonial gifts. A look of sadness came over the face of the creator sets free. Take a good long look, he said, for in the days ahead, all of this will fall to the ground. Not one log or stone will be left standing against another. They looked at him with worried faces. Wisdom keeper, when will this happen? They asked. What will be the sign? Make sure no one leads you down the wrong path, he warned them. For many will falsely represent me and say, I am the chosen one, follow me. There is no time left. Do not follow after them. When you hear of wars and uprisings, do not fear, for these things will come first. But the end is not yet. Tribal wars will break out, and nations will war against nations. There will be great earthquakes, food will be scarce, sickness will spread everywhere, and bad signs will appear in the sky. Before all of this happens, you will be betrayed by your own people. They will hunt you down, drag you into their gathering houses, and put you in jail. They will hand you over to the government and officials of the people of iron. All of this they will do to you because of me and my name. But remember, this will be your chance to represent me and tell them the good story. Do not worry about what to say ahead of time to defend yourselves, for I will give you the mouth of a wisdom keeper, and no enemy will be able to answer you or prove you wrong. You will be betrayed by your own family members and friends. They will even have some of you killed. They will all hate you because you are representing me and my teachings. But none of these things can truly harm you, so you must stand up strong and never give up trusting in me. For my life inside you will keep you walk with firm steps. The word of the Lord. And now kids can go to junior worship. Jesus loves me, this I know.
So when Lyndon was offering the welcome, I was, I'm feeling a little emotional. And then by the time we get to Lisa's prayer, and she's praying for the world, and our city and nation and church, I'm gulping a little bit, trying to hold it in. And then Ryan leads a shield about me, and I'm completely undone. So thanks for that. Man, I was sitting back there, and Cohen's learning how to run the slides, and he does the songs, and to help him along with it, he sings along so he knows when to move the slide there, and I could barely breathe when we were singing that song, and I hear him singing, man, singing those words with you all, and I was just overwhelmed with the sense, I want this for my child. I need this for my child. So thanks for giving this to me, to us. Man. You guys are good. Okay. So that's easy. We'll just do a sermon now. Here we go. They looked at him with worried faces. It's intriguing to me that for the second time in a single year, we receive basically the exact same gospel passage. A few months back, the lectionary gave us Mark 13, a nearly identical parallel to to the words we receive from Luke 21 today. And I can't help but wonder, why offer us this same scenario twice? Do they think we didn't hear it the first time around? Or that there's too much to say about it in a single Sunday? Or is it just that it's so relevant to our lives, we simply must hear this thing twice? Honestly, I'm not sure. But in the spirit of receiving our givens in life as gifts, I'm going to read this passage today as if it is something we need to hear this morning, something written just for us, which is to say, I'm going to presume that our life together at just this moment will be illuminated by what Jesus and his disciples have to say today. And with that presumption in mind, I'm just going to listen carefully to the passage. So, to help get us there, let's start with this. A historical reminder to enter us into this passage. Just a few details to help us fully get at what Jesus is driving at here today. Now, some of these details we covered a few months back when the parallel passage came up, but I figure if the lectionary feels like it can repeat itself, then so can I, at least just a bit. So let's start with this. Here's a description I came across this week in a commentary that puts this scene into proper perspective for us from Luke 21, clarifies what's really at stake. And it goes like this. According to the first century historian Josephus, the Jerusalem temple of Jesus' day was an awe-inspiring wonder. Newly reconstructed by Herod the Great, it was the pride of all Israel. And truth be told, that temple was extraordinary. According to historians, the temple's retaining walls were composed of stones 40 feet long. How they even figured out how to lift and move those remains a bit of a mystery. The temple itself occupied a platform twice as large as the Roman Forum and four times as large as the Athenian Acropolis, to name two of the most famous architectural structures of their time. On top of all that, Herod reportedly used so much gold on the walls of the temple, and here I'm quoting a historian, that anyone who gazed at them in bright sunlight risked blinding themselves. The point being, this place was magnificent. And so it is no wonder that Jesus' disciples are, in fact, dazzled by it, such that we are not at all surprised to hear his followers fawn over the adornment of this place, remarking on the handsomely carved logs, large stones, and ceremonial gifts, as our First Nations versions puts it, that made up the temple's splendor. The same sort of sentiment anyone would have had upon seeing this place. Even the Romans admired the temple. And yet, for reasons his followers cannot possibly fathom, Jesus isn't quite so impressed. And he responds this morning to their admiration with a rather chilling prediction. In the days ahead, he says, all of this will fall to the ground. Not one stone will be left standing against another. Now, I suspect that when most of us hear about the destruction of the temple, given our historical and cultural distance from first century Palestine, we equate it to little more than the demolition of this or that building we see going on in, say, downtown Portland all around us all the time. For example, I like to, on occasion, play pickleball at the East County Pickleball Courts, just down the road here on Stark. And I always find myself when I'm there hoping the place can stay in business. There's like 15 courts and it's usually just Bill, Dan, and me, you know, so I'm hoping this place can stay in business. But I realize there's a possibility that that pickleball court may not succeed, that at some point they'll have to tear down those courts and build something else in its place. And while that would be disappointing to me, it probably wouldn't register as much more than an inconvenient annoyance in the big scheme of my life. But that is not at all what these disciples are experiencing as Jesus makes his prediction today. Consider it this way. Have you noticed, by chance, that the east wing of the White House is looking a little different from how it did just a few months ago? I'm guessing you have. And have you noticed the massive amount of commentary that that has generated? Again, I am guessing that you have. Well, imagine this. Imagine that instead of just the east wing, it was the entire building. East wing, west wing, the central residence included. And imagine that not only that, but the National Cathedral in D.C. was also being torn down. And then imagine that it was all happening on 9/11. As the Twin Towers are also being struck and falling. Now, if you can get your mind around all that at once, then perhaps you are in a position to truly appreciate the impact of Jesus' statements on those disciples that day. This prediction about the temple is not simply akin to the East County pickleball courts that we're talking about here. It's not even equivalent to the east wing of the White House. The temple is the central symbol of their entire identity, spiritually, politically, economically, and socially. Which is precisely why it is such an extraordinary shock today to hear Jesus say, "These walls are coming down." And why it's then almost comical to read what Luke writes next, with typical Lucan understatement. After Jesus said this, the disciples looked at him with worried faces. Worried faces? Terrified faces is more like it. Utterly confused faces is probably more accurate. And deeply, deeply anxious hearts. To speak as Jesus is speaking today is quite literally, in their minds, to speak of the end of the world as they know it. As if Jesus is narrating them the plot of some Avengers film without the happy ending. Which makes it all the more intriguing to hear what Jesus says next. As stunned as his followers are about his prediction of the destruction of the temple, what he follows that up with is equally, if not more so, flabbergasting. "Many will falsely represent me," Jesus tells them, "and will say to you, there is no time left. The end is near. But do not believe them. Do not fear, for the end is not yet." Now the truth is, if they tear down the East County pickleball courts, it would, in fact, be the end of my pickleball career, because I'm not driving all the way out to Beaverton to play on the next nearest courts. Likewise, when his disciples hear Jesus saying the temple is coming down, they absolutely believe, because they can't imagine any other possibility, that this is the end. That there is, in fact, no time left. That this must surely be the moment of moments in Israelite history. And for Jesus to say otherwise is It's not only stunning, but stupefying and entirely counterintuitive for all of them. And yet, what he says, just maybe, is the very thing that they and we today need to hear. A couple weeks ago, I watched a recorded version of a podcast between two friends, New York Times political commentator Ezra Klein and American journalist, author, and activist Ta-Nehisi Coates. They were reflecting together on the state of our country, and Ezra Klein was speaking with some urgency about it, lamenting the many troubling things in contemporary society. He said to Ta-Nehisi Coates that this may be the most significant moment in our country's short history as a democratic republic. But Ta-Nehisi Coates, who has been as critical of American culture and politics over the past couple decades as any author I've ever come across, said in reply, "Ezra, you're wrong." And then, this is not the moment of American history. It is rather a moment. There have been others more difficult in the distant past. There will no doubt be others more difficult in the distant future. Your fears and anxieties are understandable, but not fully justifiable. We are not facing the moment. We are simply facing a moment. And when he said that, even though Klein was having a difficult time believing it, the entire tenor of their conversation shifted. And honestly, hearing him say that, something shifted in me as well. And what Coates said in that conversation is precisely what I hear Jesus saying to his disciples in their conversation. Many are going to say to you, "There is no time left. This is the end. This is the moment of moments." But do not follow them. Do not fear. The end is not yet. And I have to say to you, that is a word I need. To be clear, I don't mean I need to hear it simply in reference to American politics. Rather, what I'm trying to say to you this morning is that's a word I need to hear in reference to us. I need to hear it about East County right now. This community that is, quite frankly, the single most important community in my life. You know, I can't say what East County means for anybody else, but that's what it means for me. Which is why, in the midst of our own symbolic temple falling around us at the moment, I need to hear Jesus' words today. Do not fear. This is not the end. Because what he's really talking about here is not simply the temple, but change. Unexpected and distressing change. The moment when something sacred in our lives comes undone. Because when that sort of change occurs, it's not merely distressing, it's entirely disorienting. It's unclear how we'll move forward. Which is precisely why the disciples are so worried this day, wondering, what then, Jesus, will we do? How will we make it through this? And precisely why Jesus' reply in response to them is so remarkably instructive. Just consider for the moment the ways all the world around us
tend to respond to unexpected and disruptive and distressing change. Just imagine how we tend to respond to those moments that startle us. All those ways I'm sure you can imagine that are harmful and destructive for our world. And then note this. As Jesus responds to his disciples' worries this day and tells them what to do in the midst of this distressing change they're experiencing, I'd like you to note what Jesus does not say today. In response to their worries, Jesus emphatically does not say, find a worthy scapegoat and blame everything on them. Not one hint of that. He does not say, you're right, it's hopeless, give up, walk away, accept despair. He does not say, be resentful and fight back, or even the opposite. It's no big deal, just carry on as if nothing's happened. He says neither of those, and he most certainly does not say, there are easy answers and quick fixes. Jesus offers not one bit of that today. But if Jesus doesn't offer any of that, what then does he offer us? Again, to his followers back then and there, and to his followers right here and now. He offers this. In perhaps the single most important verse in this entire passage, Jesus says to them, remember this. One, represent me. And two, share the good story. Imitate Christ and proclaim the gospel. In every word and action and interaction and reaction you have, represent Jesus and share good news. Blame and fear, giving up and despair, easy answers and quick fixes tend to be our default habits in times of trial and change. And honestly, I sympathize with all of that. When sacred temples fall, those are the places we tend to turn first. But what I hear today is something different. What I hear today is something better. Which is why Jesus' concluding reflections are so striking to me. For he ends our passage, did you notice this? With a promise to East County today. None of this, Jesus says, the struggles and trials you face will ultimately or permanently harm you. So stand up, stand strong, and trust in me. For my life inside you, God's Spirit among you, will see you through. Now, I certainly don't have answers to exactly how we're going to make it through our own unsettling change here at East County. But I'm at least committed to this. Doing what I can to imitate Christ, continuing to share the good story, and trusting in God's Spirit to see us through. That is the gospel I hear Jesus proclaiming today. And that is the good news I'm going to choose to believe. Amen.